Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
You're listening to STEMcast, brought to you by McGill iGEM.
Hi everyone, my name is Lucy Wiggers.
And my name is Camille Heaney.
In today's episode, we'll be interviewing professionals in STEM across academia and industry, and gathering their perspectives on diversity, equity, and inclusion.
We're hoping to have what we think is an important ongoing conversation about how we can empower diverse voices in the STEM fields.
So we'll start by introducing today's speakers. First up, we are joined by Afla Hanafiya, who is a graduate student at Penn State University, researching epigenetic regulation of early mammalian development. Now, Afla is also a prominent advocate working to uplift LGBTQIA+ voices in academia and scientific research.
We are further joined by Mel Rees. Mel is a systems operator working with Enbridge in Calgary with an expertise in the energy sector. She also shares a passion for advocacy and promoting inclusivity in STEM.
And finally, today we'll hear from Anmol Nagpal, who is the CEO and co-founder of Nos Pharma, a company specializing in therapeutics for genetic neurological disorders. Anmol is also a passionate advisor in the Montreal biotech startup sphere.
So we'll kick off this episode with an introduction from our speakers. Starting with Afla, we're wondering if you could tell us a bit about your journey into STEM and how you ended up in your field of study.
I pretty much have always known that I wanted to be a scientist or work in science in some way. Since I think I was high school, from what I can remember. And I think it had a lot to do with my own sort of identity of like questioning yourself and, you know, wanting to understand like why it is that I feel a certain way, but people perceive me differently. I was doing a lot of these type of like introspective, questions about myself. And then in classes, when they talk about, you know, biology, about like, I don't know, just like life and how life is, I don't know why, I just was making the connections of like, what about me? Like, what's, mm-hmm. what is about me that is like whatever. So my curiosity had like, and I love, and I watched all these like National Geographic like documentaries and like Discovery Channel when they used to show like all these different topics about like life or whatever. I've always loved watching those, and I think all of that culminated in my interest into wanting to explore this further. So like I went through high school sort of like making it my goal to try and see if I can somehow get into a program for higher education in science in some ways. And then I end up graduating and then applying. I applied for scholarships and all of that. And that I was fortunate enough to be given the opportunity to have this opportunity to get my bachelor's degree in molecular biology at Rochester Institute of Technology. So that was back in 2013 was when I started graduating in 2017. So pretty much stuck with my major. I didn't change major. I mean, there are a couple other reasons why, because with the sponsorship, it's like pertinent for you to stay within your assigned, like me, because that's what they sponsor you for. But at the same time, like I didn't question that I wanted to stay. So there's like no issue for me. And I did do undergrad research starting, when I was in my undergrad. And that was really fun. I had a really, I think, great mentor who sadly has passed away a couple of years ago from cancer. I'm really always been sad about that because she was very encouraging. She was the type of mentor who wanted to see like her students just, I don't know, like go far. And she was the type of mentor who would give you opportunities if you show enough interest. So like if you want something and she sees it and she's like, do you want this? I'll give you the tools and I'll give you an opportunity. And so, which I don't think that there's a lot of people who's like that, but she's one of those people. And I'm always grateful for her because she opened the doors for me. Because I was also scared. I didn't really think that I was good enough as a student, as a scientist, and all these things. So, you know, when somebody like was, I don't know, I mean, it really didn't take much from them to do that, but they did. Yeah, and then after that, graduating high school, a college, I think junior, my senior year, I was already thinking of like, okay, what do I do next? Like, do I want to get a job? Like, what do I do? But I'm like, I don't know if I want to get a job right now because it feels too technical if I want to do that. I don't know, because I was still kind of like, I want to learn more. I want to kind of get a little bit more into research. And so I did, you know, start applying for grad schools and not really thinking of whether or not I wanted to be a researcher, like a PI or whatever, but it was more because I wanted to have more time to be like in, you know, sort of like in that student bubble in a sense, but not in a way that like I wouldn't be able to support myself. So I was able to get into this program here at Penn State for this for the PhD program here, and I decided to join this lab because of the topic itself was interesting to me. I think that I tried to sort of get into more you know, cancer disease related kind of research, but I don't know. I guess my head has always been like DNA, like what's happening there. And I don't know, it's like such a bad thing because like it's not easy. It's a lot of work and it's like complicated, but like, and I'm not that good, but like I just like it and it's interesting. So I'm here I am, still here. So yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that. I think it's really, I like what you said at the beginning there, like you found science and STEM as a way to discover the world, but also discover yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
So I really like that.
And now we'll ask the same question to you, Mel.
Absolutely. So I originally started in engineering at the University of Alberta, and I did a two years there. And actually my father decided to retire. And so they downsized their house. So my room was all of a sudden not there. So I had to start working. So I had to pull out of university. But it actually ended up working out. And I worked for a company who did industrial chemical cleaning. So I got to drive a really big truck around Alberta, and we would visit all kinds of industrial sites. And we'd actually use chemical cleaning to clean out the interior of giant vessels, piping, giant systems. And from there, I was like learning kind of the same thing that I was in engineering, but I was putting it into practice right away. So like it was hands-on valves, driving big trucks, working with tools, pumps, equipment, things like that. And I'm like, actually, this is feeling a bit more down my line of work than I was in engineering. So I actually pivoted and I went back through NAIT, and which is our technology program school here in Alberta. And I completed the power engineering course. And again, it was very similar stuff that I was learning in engineering at U of A, but again, just with that practical component. And that's how I kind of started in kind of the STEM field. So from there, I was in refinery operations. We had a big distillation unit, a crude unit, an asphalt plant, power forming unit, light ends unit. We did it all. And I got to work in the field, hands-on with pumps, valves, huge, like massive systems. And it was a ton of fun. Like I literally just actually loved my job and what I was doing. It had a bit of a danger element, which I was also kind of liked as well. You really had to be thinking on your feet. A lot of problem solving skills were required at that time as well. And then that drove me into the control room. So you're actually at the panel pushing the buttons for all of these valves and these systems. And so I was in the control center for 3 years. And then I found this job working for Enbridge to control one of the biggest natural gas pipelines in North America. And again, into the control center here down in Calgary. And that's how I ended up where I am today. So I've been with Enbridge now for about 2 years. 2.5 years, and it's been a great transition. And you know, I wouldn't change anything how I got here.
That's awesome. Sounds like you were thrown right into that like engineering from an early age. That's really, really cool.
And finally, let's hear from Anmol.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, absolutely happy to do a little bit of background on myself. So, started in STEM in 2012. I moved to Montreal to pursue neuroscience at McGill. Did my undergrad at McGill, then did my master's at McGill, also in neuroscience. And I've been kind of in STEM since I was 19. Like, I've been working in the lab since I was 19, and really always thought I would be in STEM and studying biology, neuroscience, for my career. Actually, that was my objective. So I've been around STEM for a long time.
Awesome. And how did you just get into your company and how did that process go for you?
It's kind of like a kind of accidental almost. It wasn't so intentional. It wasn't like I did STEM, now I'll start a company. I finished my master's during COVID. I got a job actually working in the hospital genetic testing lab at the MUHC. And then I decided, you know what, I think I'm just going to leave STEM. I think I'll quit STEM. I'll quit academia, I'll quit science altogether, and I will move into business. And so I had applied to a business program at Queen's in 2021 or late 2021, 2022, and had basically planned to move to Kingston, which I did end up doing, and pursuing my business degree. But in the meantime, my now co-founder had called me up one day. He's also a professor at McGill, and said, "Hey, I'm starting a biopharma company." I knew about the project because when I was a grad student, he was working on it, and we had spoken about it in a collaborative way, with my lab and his. And then he basically said, "Look, I want to spin out the company from McGill and the technology. I don't want to do the business part because it's not my expertise. You're going to business school. It seems like that's the transition you want to make. Do you want to take on the business part of it?" And I thought, why not? Like, let's just give it a go. Honestly, I didn't think an opportunity like that would necessarily present itself again. And I just kind of jumped in and said, sure, let's give it a go. I still went to business school and then came back and started the company once I was done.
That's really cool. Thanks for, telling us a bit about your journey. And it's cool. I feel like career paths are so non-linear. So it's cool how you had that sort of moment of that moment of pivoting there.
So thank you all so much for your responses. We'll move on with our next question, and this one is pretty personal to me. So as a queer woman in a field like engineering, which has historically and currently been fairly male dominated, I think a lot about my own entry into the workforce and how I'll be able to show up in professional spaces as a queer person. So I'm wondering from your perspectives.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Do you feel that you are able to bring your authentic self to work? And what is some advice you would offer young professionals on that front? Let's start again with Afla.
I mean, to me, I think personally, okay, so I identify as a transgender woman. And I think before I even was comfortable kind of taking or like taking that as like that's who I am, even though it's like it's in my head, but it's just whatever. I don't think people will entertain that. That before I was comfortable to really, what's the word? Like own it, own that.
Yeah.
Other people were already affirming me, and it was very weird because gender dysphoria tells you one thing, but then I don't know, like society tells you the other. So it's, I don't know, it's mixed. So it's, this is my personal experience. And I know that for a lot of femme people, trans femme, trans women, they don't have that experience, like, that I have had. So that made it easy for me to navigate because they were already like affirming me without me even was prepared to be affirmed. And so that helped with me getting into my self that I knew was has always been there. And so I that part I can't really say for other people because I know that that's not a universal experience. And that gave me a lot of privilege of navigating life, first of all, is one thing. Workplace is the other thing. But these are the hurdles that a lot of people go through that just impedes their day-to-day life, which I don't necessarily experience for the most part. And so I kind of skip that sort of struggle a little bit, right? And people don't question my gender identity. So I can be myself because I'm perceived as what they think I am, that I am already, that I already am. So that's easy. So, and but I do have colleagues and friends who struggle with being able to be themselves. We have more gender non-conforming people, people who present themselves not in the binary of what we know as men or women or whatever that means, right? That in the workplace, they do have to tamper down certain things about themselves, how they, operate day to day, like how they talk, how they walk, how they dress, like how they present themselves. And even in the workplace, it sometimes becomes like an issue of like, oh, because of this, you're that or whatever, which is like, why? So it's obvious for other people that you're thinking about their gender presentation, even though you say that you're trying to be inclusive or you're trying, but that's not what that is. Like you are trying to make that a point, so, and especially because my school is in central Pennsylvania, so it's not in a big city, it's not like in an urban progressive, you would say, area. And so in general, like living here is a little bit different. So again, I'm afforded that privilege of being able to navigate for the most part quite, I think, without much trouble, I should say, because I haven't really experienced some like insane transphobia or anything like that, like directed at me.
The experiences of my colleagues and my friends
Yes,
who,
yes, yes, yes.
who's like not, I don't know, conventionally like man or woman like presenting, which is BS. I mean, I know we can't swear, but like, but also because we live in central PA, so this is not like a city that, even in the city, you still get a lot of this type of sentiments and like prejudice and stuff. So it's not even like, not to say that, oh, if you go to like Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or like New York, they're going to be like better. It's not like, that's not it, you know? But it's not like, it's a little bit easier, I should say, to find people and to kind of like be able to find some sort of a acceptance, in this type of society. Anywho, yeah, but like for me personally, like I don't really experience that. I think I used to be a lot more self-conscious about like how I present in the beginning. I was, I kind of made sure that like, oh, I have to wear this or that, like put up some makeup, just a little bit to cover myself up, all these things. Like I did all that. But then grad school really has a way to just grind you down to the bones that I was like, this is insane. I do not give an F anymore of how do I look or whatever, because this thing is beating my ass. So guess what? I'm gonna just wear what I'm gonna wear. I don't wanna put this or that. Baby don't like me, look away. You don't want to talk to me? They don't talk to me. Because guess what? I have to come into work. I have to do all this work until late at night, some days, a lot of days, and I don't have time for that. So that's me. Other people, different experience, a lot more struggles and hurdles that they have to go through. But I think that, and it's hard if you the school itself is doesn't there's no real like if the your workplace environment isn't a place that wants to actually like make sure that the people who's working are comfortable and happy, like actively trying to make that, then that's never going to happen. Like you really have to just deal with that, which is the reality for a lot of people working in science, unfortunately, right? Not just science, probably like any other field, but like I can talk about like academia because I am have been in academia for so long.
I like that. I like your mindset, though, just to not really care
Oh God, yeah, sorry. And then I got older. You know, I was in my 20s, and then now I'm like 32. And it's like, oh God, like this is insane. Like, why am I doing this right now? My back is hurting, my neck is hurting, and my knees are locking up every 5 steps that I take. So this is not working.
That's so fair. So thank you for sharing that. And now we can hear from Mel.
Yeah, so I will age myself a little bit. When I started in engineering, like my first day of class in engineering back a while ago, there was only three women students in my class of 350 when we started. So I feel you there. there wasn't many of us, and I did struggle initially. So moving that into the workforce, same thing. I was ever only the only, typically the only girl on site. You're kind of made a bit of a novelty. This was, this is like 15 years ago I'm talking. It's definitely improved the being in the field and in the on the work sites. There's definitely a lot more women than there used to be, which is phenomenal. But yeah, it was tough initially. I definitely, and I wouldn't suggest people did this. I don't think I did it correctly. Looking back on my career, but I did it. How I approached it was a way for me to get through. And at the time, that was all I knew. I was also a lot younger. I didn't really have enough backbone yet, or those good witty comments to kind of snuff some of the bad perspectives out very quickly. And just to kind of garner that respect for even just myself. I definitely bent a little bit more to try to blend in. And I wouldn't suggest that that's the way to do it. I don't agree now with how I approached it was the right way. And so this is why I'm hoping to talk to you folks to try to help people to not do what I did. So I did the thing of blending in. I was trying to be one of the guys. So I was a part of the problem. I was making inappropriate jokes. I was, if there was other women on site, I really wouldn't connect with them. I was just trying to really kind of protect myself by hanging out with the guys that I knew and who knew me. And yeah, so like I definitely have regrets on how I started out my career of not showing up as my true self. And that definitely affected how I performed and how I worked. There's definitely like I worked extremely hard because I have to prove myself to everyone because every new person I met, I had to prove that I was good enough to be there. And that drove, I guess, a lot of good things. Like it did drive my work ethic, and I learned my learning curve went up so much just because I was asking questions, getting in there. But yeah, there came a downside too, where I definitely did not respect either like myself where I was at, and at times I was mean to other people in order to kind of cover my tracks. And that wasn't right. And that is one of my regrets from back in those days. But further in my career, that definitely changed when, especially when more women started becoming more prevalent onto the work sites. That game that I was playing before wasn't the play. You have to make friends and you have to get that support group. And finally, like it did feel like a bit of breathing room when more women are out there and you're like, oh my God, okay, you're going through this as well. And that was a really, really good release. And then it started to be like, there's enough of us. Okay, we can actually support each other and reach out to each other and even just, you know, just coffee chats, you know, it's great. So the environment has definitely changed, I would say, over the last 15, 20 years that I have experienced. But there is still a ways to go, for sure.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And let's finish with Anne Mulligan.
I guess there's a like lab part of me. So when I was in the lab all the time, it was a pretty, okay. So diverse can mean a lot of things. It can mean diverse, in terms of, ethnic origin or background, not white. So, but there was, it's not like I ever felt that there weren't a lot of Indians in the lab, which is honestly true. There were a lot. So I never felt like that wasn't, there was a lack of diversity there. Weren't a lot of queer people in the lab. I think it was just me. So, you know, it wasn't so diverse, but at the same time, universities are diverse. Maybe my specific lab necessarily wasn't. So I didn't feel like a wanting necessarily of having other queer people. I had like a whole separate life outside of the lab, so could just kind of go there. But I think like there were decisions that I wanted to, like we had to make for when I started the company, which was, it's kind of like I'm in pharma, and pharma's pretty old school and antiquated. Even if it's very innovative, there were decisions around, like I remember asking my co-founder at the time, he's much older than me, maybe not much older, I think he'd be annoyed if I said much older, but he's older than me. And I had asked him, I was like, well, do you think I need to like take my nose ring out if we're going to business meetings? Do you think that would be bad if I kept it in? I'm not sure how everyone will respond. I was more worried about the business world, less the STEM university space, because I find the university space is a little bit of a bubble. And everyone is pretty open-minded in that bubble overall, comparatively to the rest of the world. So the harder decisions for me were actually outside of academia. They were more in the business sense. And as you can tell, I did not take out my nose ring. The decision was made to keep it in. I did get a smaller one, maybe a little bit like less conspicuous, but decided that I can't like I'm just not going to remove my whole personality completely. So yeah, I'm happy to answer other questions around diversity, but those are kind of like my two experiences with it. One I call the academic world, and the other one outside of that closed system, which is the rest of the world. And I find the rest of the world is a little bit more complicated to deal with than academia was for me.
No, that's definitely fair. I do feel like, and even especially in Montreal, it is that bubble you were talking about. And for me, it's like more the fear of out in industry, out in big companies, how does it look like there versus in the academic field? So I get what you're saying on that front.
Yeah.
So this next one is pretty on the nose for our discussion today. We're wondering, what are some of the current DEI challenges that you've encountered or observed in STEM spaces that need addressing, especially given that DEI has become such a charged word lately? Let's hear first from Afla.
So there's so many things that have been problematic since before this whole debacle around like DEI. Oh my gosh, like you're in here because you're a minority. Like that's why you're like, first of all, you're already in the wrong like book. You're in a wrong timeline. That is not the actual real experience, because guess what? People actually did research, and they actually did a poll, multiple polls actually, and which they found that, like, you know, people of color and like other minorities pretty much literally have to put at least twice as much as of work to be able to get to where they are. People get to where they are because if they're people of color, that means that they really actually had to go through hurdles to get there that other people do not have to go through, right? But this whole thing of just like disinformation and misinformation about like, oh, because of DEI, because they have a quota, because of this, that's why you're there. That's already have existed, right? Because up until that point where we are now, we do not have the ample and the appropriate level of structure and policy to ensure that diverse people are being hired, are being maintained in their workplace and being treated as if they're actual human beings. And of course, you have all these institutional policies with DEI prior to how we are now about accepting this, about like being more mindful, being for whatever, da, 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 which is like, that's nice, but we need things that are structural. Because I will say this, if you have policies that protect certain people, protect minorities, guess what? That's going to trickle down and that's going to benefit everyone. Like, that's just the truth. If there's protections because of a basic human rights for certain people, that is because of the basis of that human right, that should apply to everyone. So if like, that's just the, people don't understand that part enough, right? I think that but now obviously we're in such a precarious times and things have gone 180 that we're no more DEI. Like suddenly every institution is just, oh, we're not doing that. Like, no, this is not, this climate is. So again, my comment on that is that if you rely on the people in power to affirm you, to say that you are accepted or that you deserve, what do you call that, safety, and for you to be able to do your work just like everyone else and not have to deal with all this like insanity, then guess what? You're probably not actually going to get a lot. And if they're going to give you something, they can take it back. And we have seen them take it back. So what do I say to that? I say that people who are working in research institutions, in academia, in, you know, universities, in all these places, that we should realize, and in anywhere at all, I should say, that we should realize that there is power in us coming together as colleagues, as workers. There is power in that. And we have seen this happening the past 5, 6, 10 years, in which there are more and more employees who are organizing, who are taking charge of their conditions at their workplace, because that works, because we have a say, each of us have a say to how it is that we get treated and how we can control our own lives as we are working, right? Which we did not have before because we let them decide. We ask for them to give us certain things that we should already, that's already in, that we are entitled to, right? So this is my stance on this. The institutions and universities, they can continue to do what they want to do. Either they're going to go hard and double down on DEI, or they're going to switch up, or they're rebrand or whatever. They can do all of that because that's what they are, an institution that can do whatever they want. So let them do it. But what are we going to do about that? So that's the question that we have to ask ourselves. And we have to start talking with our colleagues, our peers, and in a way materially make take steps to you know, organize so that we're able to protect ourselves, because in the end, that is how we survive.
And now from Mel.
So at least I'll kind of take on part one first. Definitely the struggles I've seen is, one, just visibility is number one. I think people don't quite understand the power of just seeing a little, you know, rainbow flag posted somewhere. I think that that's very helpful. I'm also a queer woman, so I know if somebody's got a little rainbow flag, you're like, hey, it just breaks down that barrier, and I just know that there's not going to be a problem. Whereas when that's not prevalent, it's kind of a you gotta feel it out. So I think exposure is a big one. And just being seen and recognized is very important, just so that like people are aware. And this is also saying like I live in Calgary, so a metropolis, it's obviously a bit easier in kind of the urban areas. But if you're talking northern Alberta or just anywhere kind of more rural, that's a lot different. We have a lot of our assets that are down in the States too, and it's just not as welcome. So you do have to be about you have to be conscious of where you are and what supports are available to you in those places, and you might have to reach a bit further in order to attain those supports if you do need them. But I do think it's critical that those supports are there for people in whatever aspect. This is tricky because unfortunately, companies have had to shift the way that they speak and say things because it is affecting their bottom line. And ultimately, a company is there to make money. So if we have to change how we phrase things or say things in order to essentially keep contracts, they're going to do that. It's unfortunate. It does not affect my job. Like I am showing up as Mel every day, and Mel is going to be a hard worker. She's going to do her best. She might make a mistake, but she's going to learn from it, and we're going to move on. So my queerness does not affect how I work. Do I want to be in a space or a company that, it's not an issue or I have to hide it? Absolutely. I understand the state of the world right now is where we're shifting those words. I don't like it. It sets a different tone. But I go out and seek those companies where that's still one of their core values or a key value within their company. And I think that those companies are out there, and you do have to kind of seek that if that is something that is important to you. So it is a touchy subject because companies are going to do whatever they need to do in order to make a buck. And that's what we're here for, is that's why we go to work, is to make a buck. But you'll have to align your values of what you weight is the most important. Like if being able to speak freely at your job is, number one, then you need to go seek a company where that's going to be okay. And also don't put yourself in a position where you are, out in the middle of nowhere with no support, right? Or if you're comfortable in yourself that doesn't bother you, then you can go for it. So there is a bit of a waiting game there. But again, that's going to be up to your personal experience and your preference. And I understand also, like as students coming into the workforce, that's something that you also have to decide as well, because just because like I have 15 years industry experience, so that already gives me a leg up as to where I can work and things. But obviously, as students coming in, that is something that you might need to consider. So, yeah.
That was an awesome answer. Honestly, that like ties back to the whole visibility thing too, because I know like if I'm, wanting to intern at a company or something like that, and I see that they have something rainbow on their website or something, or in an interview, like that already puts me in such a better place. And it already gives me a little clue as to whether that's the place for me. So I really like that answer there. That was really, really nice.
And now from Anmol.
Yeah. Yeah, this one's tough because everything's very drastically changed very quickly. A lot of DEI initiatives are either ended or unfunded because sponsors have pulled out. I will emphasize that again, a lot of the challenges that some people will face in DEI are not necessarily challenges I will face or did face. Still a man. It's not, again, it's not like Indian men are underrepresented in STEM. So for me, it was often viewing other folks experience DEI challenges. Like my trans peers, had a very different experience from myself in academia. And I'm absolutely certain that they have a different experience in the rest of the world, so to speak, in the workplace, the way they show up. It's a little bit different. I'm like pretty cis looking. There's not a lot of personal hurdles for me to face anymore. But that was kind of in, like, I moved to Montreal because I knew that this was a more open place, right? Like, if I was still living, I grew up in Winnipeg. If I was still living in Winnipeg, it was a little different. So, a little bit more challenging. But here, I don't face this the same way. I do face racism or have at least here, in a different way, but that's actually within the queer community, not
Interesting.
outside of it, which is interesting. But I think for DEI in general and DEI initiatives, I think that they like need to be more targeted towards folks who probably need it more, like women in STEM, like trans people in STEM. I'm not sure I'm necessarily the right person to take advantage of those initiatives because I feel like I have already, like I've used them to the capacity that I needed them in the time I needed them, and I think the needs have shifted.
I like that answer a lot, and I think it is true. And because of current political climates, definitely views have shifted on a lot of very specific groups for sure. But yeah, no, I like that answer a lot. All right, and this last question really follows up on the previous question. So, from your perspectives, what further work can and needs to be done to not only include but empower diverse voices in STEM? So let's start with Afla again. And Afla, you're working in scientific academia. So how can we really create safe spaces where all individuals, particularly queer and trans individuals, can thrive within education and research?
We have to start advocating for each other. We have to start acknowledging, and when we look across the hall next to us, left and right, that this is where our actual strength comes from, is from each other. And so there, like you said, you have said it very nicely about their strength in community, and that is true. So for scientists out there who are just starting, or who's, I don't know, who's already far in their field, I guess that I think I'm probably preaching to the choir, but for people who probably haven't really realized it yet, but like you it, there is it's it really important for us to start acting as a community to be able to empower ourselves is one thing, but to also to protect ourselves is the other thing, because at this in these times that's very, very important. And so like within our own, you know, level of you know status of a workplace, that there should already be that conversations about standing up for each other, and not have to, I would say, wait for, you know, people higher in the higher positions to allow you to do certain things, or allow you to do certain things in a sense to protect yourselves. You know what I mean? Like if it helps for you to start a group, then start a group. Like there is, what else can you do? Like if you're gonna keep waiting, you're just, if you want to wait, then okay, wait, right? Like I don't know, you can do that. I mean, I'm not saying that it's useless, it's not, because we do have to work in multiple, you know, with multiple channels on this, but the core has to be us. Like we have to be the one to, within, like amongst each other, that has to be the core.
So now we'll hear from Mel. And from your experience in a very well-established and frankly massive oil and gas company, where do those kinds of DEI conversations start?
So the work to be done for me, I'm not a very out and like proud person, but I value the connections I make with people. I think that we are all human, and I have an ability just to have conversations with anybody. Doesn't matter what part of the company you're from. And I think that the huge value is in connecting with people in just a very natural human form. Sometimes I know, you know, having a rainbow flag thrown in your face is not the best technique to kind of connect with some folks. And like, I mean, I would get that too if a flag was flown in my face that I'm like, I don't know if I know what this means, you know? So my ability to connect with people in a conversational sense, I think, is a good lesson for many folks who are trying to just kind of navigate some spaces where maybe there's not already something that's set up as like a support network. But just like having natural conversations and subtly dropping kind of hints and things about just making an inclusive space, or just like slightly challenging conversations of, you know, like just like, oh, what would you think about this? Like asking questions, I think, is A plus. The more questions you can ask, the more answers you're going to get out of people. So I think that that's a great subtle way to do work in a workplace in order to make it more inclusive, because people love asking questions. They want to know. So if I can share my story with someone and we can relate on some sort of level, I consider that a positive thing. Here at Enbridge, we do have like more formal support groups. So we have ERGs, so employee resource groups, and they are fantastic. So that is like a grassroots built support network through the company that's funded by the company. And so we have one for disabilities, folks who are taking care of elderly parents. We just have a general like networking one. We have women at Enbridge. We also have the women, like our feminine is our females in engineering group. So there's a ton that you can kind of, everybody can fall into something and find that extra support that they need. And I do think that that is Enbridge's, one of Enbridge's major values is that inclusivity part. And I think that that alone, if we can get more companies to buy into a system like that, where it's grassroots fed, but still funded from the top down, like that alone already sets a stage for just like, I'm in a safe place to show up to work every day. Another way too is just the reaching back out. So that's why I'm talking to you folks today. I think it's really important to give back to the community. Like there was no supports when I started work, so I definitely felt alone, and I'm sure there's still folks today who feel alone. But through these conversations that we have, hopefully we can reach more people and say that, you know, you might have to search a little bit further outside of your close network, but yes, there are people who are going through the same thing and want to hear your story or can help and help support you. So I think just getting that outreach is my role in kind of the whole system. And from there, I think it's honestly, it turns a bit political too. Like that avenue is always taken, and that's everyone's personal preference. But if we're not careful, you know, like, things change. So stand up for what you think is right. And, you know, go vote. I think that's hugely important as Canadians in a democracy. I think you need to do that, whatever way you need to. But just educating yourself, you know, getting a whole world view, like just becoming more of a well-rounded human, I think is, it's not going to hurt you. And again, I just think going back to those just natural conversations and just connecting with people, I don't think that we're all out to get each other. I think we're all in a crazy world that doesn't always make sense. And we're just tiny little humans trying to do a really good job. And that's what I think is the biggest connector, is just being human, and everybody's different, and that's okay.
All right. And last but not least, Anne Moll, from your work in the startup ecosystem, how can we really promote DEI from the get-go, especially when founding and starting up a company?
There's like two lenses to this answer, because the first lens is a practical one, which is we're like a startup with 3-4 people. There are really no DEI initiatives explicitly, because there's just no capacity to have DEI initiatives. There's not even enough people to have initiatives around. We're not hiring. So it's a little bit tough. But the other lens to this answer is a lot of founders are from underrepresented groups, or they tend to be, in what I've seen. Like, a lot of founders are people of color. A lot of founders are immigrants. A lot of founders are women, more and more these days. And I think the initiatives are not necessarily important to have at a individual startup level, but maybe more at a support organization level, whether that's giving like organizations that give opportunities for underrepresented groups to start their own companies. I think that's the lens to take it at. Of course, when you get big enough as a startup and you're kind of shifting towards becoming a small medium enterprise, then there's questions around like HR hiring practices and all sorts of other DEI things that come later. But I'll be honest, I haven't had a chance to explore those yet because I don't have the need for hiring or the things that would revolve around that. So I really think, at least from the experience I have now, it's from a support organization perspective, whether it's the university, whether it's incubators here, how can they specifically support underrepresented groups to have more access towards entrepreneurship? Whether that's specific tailored programming for a specific group, it can look a lot of different ways. There's lots of examples. I think DMZ has a Black Entrepreneurs program in Toronto at TMU. There's like VC funds that only fund underrepresented groups. There's a new venture capital fund launched out of Canada called Misfit Ventures that specifically funds founders who are LGBTQ identifying. So I think there are specific initiatives, and I think there's appetite for funding them in Canada.
Yeah.
And maybe Canada will just become a little bit more center in those initiatives as things change south of the border around DEI initiatives. And that I don't know, but I do think it's at an organization level, multiple organizations, and not necessarily at an individual startup. And I'd probably give you a different answer if I was a larger company.
Thank you so much, everyone, for taking the time today to have this conversation. I think we can all agree that our discussion has shed some light on the current DEI challenges across STEM fields. But personally, I think my biggest takeaway from this conversation was a message of hope. DEI lies ultimately in community and humanity and compassion, and it's our job as students and leaders to get that message across.
For me, it's inspiring to hear from all your different perspectives and experiences, and to see professionals such as yourselves thriving across all different fields. As Lucy said, I am hopeful for a future where all individuals feel empowered and uplifted in STEM. Thank you to all of our listeners. We truly hope you took something away from our conversation today.